Okay, Ben, we're trying to talk about them, the listener.
We're trying to talk about you listening to this. That's what we're trying to do. Yeah.
Yeah, we're talking about you. Mm. Okay. It occurred to me that the differences on the surface in our sensibility is that...
And you're talking about differences not between us and the listener. You're talking about differences between you and me, between Bob and Ben.
Yes, yes. Is that insensibility is something like this. Is that you present a very childish agenda with a patina of seriousness, okay? And that I present a very serious agenda with a patina of childishness.
Yeah, well, childishness is very interesting, as Sigmund Freud started arguing in the modern world. I'm slightly thrown by this. Have I got a serious core or not?
But well, you are serious when you talk on your show. You quote serious stuff and philosophers and everything, but it's all to celebrate Jim McDoodle and the improvised autonomous moment.
Well, yeah, you can say that, but it's partly because I think serious philosophy needs a shock, that I'm interested in serious philosophy, but for it to work and for it to communicate and not just be a kind of kitsch representation of seriousness, I think it needs to face everything, and particularly its opposite, which is frivolity and jokes and something that works now. And so I think for serious philosophy to be wakened up again, it needs this kind of sting. So maybe that's why I use frivolity. It's not really frivolity as an end in itself. I have my eye on philosophy and the history of philosophy.
Right, and I could say the same thing about myself, the opposite of what you just said, that I am ultimately not serious and appear to be serious, but mix it in with childishness. So you put the two, the polarity I set up there, actually come and rub against each other. So I deny what I started off with, but it was an opening surface thought. I think we're exactly the same.
But what exactly are we? I mean, it'd be slightly tedious for anyone listening to this to be told, well, and this is why I never like those introductions people give to poets or authors in bookshops, where they start listing all the books they've done, and they've done this and done that, and you feel kind of hostile towards them because they've done all this thing, and you're thinking, well, I don't really want to know all this. I want to know what you'll do with us now. I want to know how you'll stand up and what you'll say to us and how you're going to behave, and these kind of preambles don't really work. And I think you're like that because you've maintained a kind of anonymity and mysteriousness within the world of media, so no one can quite pin you down, and I hope that's because you want them to respond to what you're actually saying now rather than have some kind of resume that allows them to read you before they even hear you.
Bingo. That's exactly my agenda. I don't care what my past has been. I'm here today, and that's what we're trying to do in this show. What we said previous three shows, maybe it's four shows. This is the fifth show, right? The fifth dialogue.
This is the fifth show, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, that was relevant, what we said last week, but every week's different, and I'm living in the moment as much as possible, not as an aesthetic, but I'm interested in engaging and having a great day today. So I want to interact with aliveness, with live people or something interesting, which doesn't have to be in person. That's why I check out your show every week. I find it interesting, the music. And I was thinking that, I had a British mother and a French father. So the interesting thing was there's something British in me, and it's sort of like the best of the British childishness or eccentricity or something. And I see that in you. I see us as similar in some way, in temperament. It might be the British aspect. I don't know. It's the good part of the British Monty Python-esque kind of sense of humor. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. I mean, the British, although I only understood that when a Frenchman, André Breton, the surrealist, said, you can't really have surrealism in Britain because you've already had Lewis Carroll. That once you've had Alice in Wonderland and all the children have read Alice in Wonderland when they're little in Britain, that experience means that you can't find surrealism a great revolutionary art movement because you already had it when you were kids. And Breton said that, and I hadn't. I'm not a chauvinist about Britain or anything. I never really thought about national types, but when I read that by Breton, it made me reflect upon the things you're talking about, and where does Monty Python come from, and what is this character? This character is very bound up with repression. It's very bound up with a kind of bad side, with a kind of inability to communicate with each other. People sitting, not talking in the subway. When I've been in New York, everybody talks to each other on the subway. In fact, traveling on the subway is absolutely exhausting because you get into these really intense conversations with everybody. In London, it's much more relaxing because no one talks to each other. They stare at the floor. They look really cold and unfriendly. But the reverse side of this repression is this release in this kind of craziness, this slightly febrile sense of humour.
Yes, first of all, when I was in London recently, I noticed that each person has a chair to sit in, like it's their living room. They have separate chairs with armrests, right? They don't have that in New York. And that was sort of, that would support McLuhan's idea that British culture and Canadian culture, not so much French culture, is visually biased, which meant that the visual sense and the detachment that the visual sense creates and the repression the visual sense creates in relation to the other senses is the main national characteristic of the English, and it's expressed in their phrase where they have expressed a sense of knowing it all. They say, I know it like the back of my hand. Oh. It's the back of the hand which indicates the visual bias, whereas the Russian says, I know it like the palm of my hand. That's the more tactile part of the hand. But I think of Zappa saying, he said it, I think, around the time of his trial with the Queen, with Royal Albert Hall, he said that the English are the most eccentric people in the world, which I found pretty interesting that Zappa said that.
Yeah, being the most eccentric in the world is a pretty weird thing to try and think, because the world's round, and if you're eccentric, you're off circle. So if you're the most off circle, are you still on the world?
Well, when I read that, if you're still on the world, I don't know how to respond to that yet, Ben, but I was thinking that when I went to concerts in England, there always were wacky, skinny guys who looked like the British loony. You know what I mean? I don't think the British loony vibe I saw too much in New York concerts, but I did see them in England. And definitely something strange in the enthusiastic audience member, and that's probably what Zappa was seeing a lot.
Yeah,
I mean, you were probably one of them.
Yeah, and it was nice of Frank to see that, because he'd said very rude things about the English. He had a bad time at the Albert Hall, the trial about the concert that was banned because of obscenity, and then he. Many years later, he finally got to the English courts, and he lost completely, as you do if you try and fight it out in a foreign legal system, in the same way that Gail Zappa has lost her legal fights in Germany over her attempting to close down the Zappanale. And so when you're in a foreign land and you try and do all the legal stuff, you suddenly realize there are all these people, and the law is theirs, and they're looking at you and saying, who is this damn Frank Zappa, you know, guy with a funny moustache talking in a funny way, and we're going to defend the Albert Hall, even though what they did was, you know, appalling, actually, just banning a concert on arguing that some lyrics they didn't like, and then Zappa proved in court that he could have changed the lyrics. He rewrote them, and they made him, he went out and he changed, you know, instead of the places that you go is filled with guys from groups who want to push her pants in. I haven't got that quite right. You know, he turned it into full of guys from Pudsey who want to buy her some sudsy. You know, he proved that he could change the lyrics. But even so, he lost the trial because he was taking on the British establishment on their home ground. And yeah, that's not allowed. But I want to get back to
okay,
your...
Okay, before you do, I want to explain another
sorry.
Part.
Yeah,
McLuhan said that the North American does not put on a corporate tribal voice. He puts on a private voice.
Uh-huh.
And he said the British put on a corporate tribal voice. That's the what we call Noah's the English accent. And he said that the people who put on a tribal voice to the literate private American, North American, that's quite intimidating and alien to them. So I was thinking, I mean, when we see the judge with his silly wig on and all that, that's a corporate role he's playing. And it's a tribal thing, not a private personal point of view or a private sensibility. And so I thought that pretty insightful, McLuhan explaining why the private voice, which, I mean, Americans don't go around putting on the public English accent voice, which may not be the case anymore because it's a different world now, but we're talking back in the 50s. And that they find it alienating when someone puts on this, quote, English accent. But that's just the way the British, who were more oral than the Americans, even though the Americans and British were both visual biased, but the British were more oral and feudal and not as visually biased as the Americans in some ways. The putting on a tribal voice like that is, struck them as weird. That may be what Zappa was reacting to.
But that voice you're talking about, this is very interesting. Everybody has run away from it. You know how you, when you're growing up, you think you're doing something very unique and it's your own rebellion. Then as you really grow up, you realize how everybody else was doing it too. I had that experience with accents because I reacted against the class implications of my own upbringing and my where I came from. I didn't like it, and it was a barrier for me for talking to, I was hitchhiking a lot, lorry drivers who were often from Scotland or from Manchester, and they spoke their own brogue, their own accents, and here was I with a received pronunciation, posh voice, and I didn't like the barrier. So I attempted to, I didn't want to put on another accent, I wanted to be sincere, so I kind of decided to not emphasize those aspects, but to develop a way of talking that seemed just more normal and less refined. And if you look at the BBC and you look at how the English accent, how powerful media have treated it, it's all been changed so that now the classical posh accent of the 1950s is a figure of fun. Everybody finds it ridiculous. No one talks like that anymore. It's like amazingly funny because everyone has changed their way of talking, that this demotic idea has really gone in. And it wasn't just me as a upset left-wing middle-class person who changed my voice. It's like the whole culture changed its voice. So now on the BBC you can hear regional accents and all that is allowed, and things have shifted.
Did you know, you probably didn't know, that McLuhan predicted that in Understanding Media in 1964? Predicted that would happen.
Yeah. Well, which, it would, if you pay attention to the fact that actual voices are now available, not the written word, if you're interested in that, that's an obvious problem that will have to be faced. I mean, McLuhan's correct, and it's interesting, but it's a result of paying attention to the difference between reading words where you have to have a convention. I mean, George Bernard Shaw had an argument that we should have a phonetic transcription so that everybody could write easily. There wouldn't be these conventions. But this ignores the fact that if you did that, it would all fall apart because everybody would write in a different way because everybody says words slightly differently. So writing down is an agreement, isn't it, about what the word is and however you pronounce it, and then you pronounce it in different ways. But once you get not writing it down, once you get media, once you get recorded voices, things change absolutely. I mean, I'm not sure that we've, McLuhan or you or me, have quite understood. You know, that's why I'm talking to you, because I don't think it's settled, you know. The one thing that irritates me about talking to you, Bob, is that you feel like if you've said McLuhan said it, then it's settled. But I'm not sure it is. I think it's the interesting issue, this difference between hearing talk on recorded media or things that you can hear and the written word. But I'm not sure I've read the answer yet.
No, McLuhan would agree with you. He always said that he'd be the last to be McLuhanite, and he was just pointing out patterns that developed from a study of the symbolists, the vortices, and other people, and Harold Innes. He said, well, that meme, that way of thinking, leads to one saying this. And he would say what I just said he predicted. But he did not mean that that was the answer.
Yeah.
I'm bringing in the McLuhan points because he has, it's undeniable, he has touched on a factor in modern society and in the class war and all that, whatever revolutionaries are trying to do, that has to be understood, has to be dealt with. I don't know how we're going to understand it, but here's the thing. Just to follow this pattern, so he said television caused an identity crisis for all cultures. So the more oral British culture would become, more visually biased, as you said, literate tribal voice, they moved to fragmented accents. And he said America, being this private voice self, under TV would gravitate more to putting on the British tribal effect. And so that's where the rise of slang, like where people, grown adults going around, well, I'm looking for where it's at, and saying groovy. People who grew up in the first half of the 20th century in the United States would never say, act like that and talk like that. They call it the dumbing down of American culture, but actually the dumbing down is just the private voice American under the culture effect of television, which it threatens their identity, adapt and put on a more corporate voice, a more tribal thing. And as Zappa said, act like a dumb shit and they'll teach you treat you as an equal. That whole thing in Cheese, he's criticizing people thinking they have to dumb themselves down. In McLuhan terms, that's Zappa with a literate sensibility, individualist 19th century literate private sensibility, criticizing the corporatization effect of sensibility that TV, as McLuhan said, would inevitably happen in the United States. That's interesting. That's why I find what Frank says illustrates some of McLuhan's points, and Zappa being unaware of what McLuhan would say about what Zappa said. You know, that's what's interesting.
I feel like I'm getting a torrent of ideas, and I'm like trying to grab onto a piece of wood or something where I can know where I am.
That's post maelstrom.
Well, that's where we are. And
That's a new thought. It makes you think.
Mm-hmm. And it's hard. Let me just.
Well, let's go back to the one I couldn't get of yours. Something about being off the planet. I didn't get what you meant by that.
Just a joke about the meaning of eccentric. You know that was a purely silly diversionary pun, and doesn't really belong. Although, of course, it all belongs if you can just get long enough to belong it.
In light of what I said, it made you think. How does that affect the agenda of getting rid of the class war or overcoming the class war?
Oh, yeah, I got it, Bob. When you were talking about, we're talking about, in a way, there's a word for it. It's received pronunciation, or people even say BBC pronunciation. It was a particular way of talking which had authority. And the media have got, over the last 20 years, have got very aware of how it annoys people, and they've used lots of mechanisms and employing people with various regional accents in positions to hide the fact, to pretend that really authority doesn't exist anymore, and we're all part of a multivocal, polyvocal, beautiful universe. Of course, this is a surface. Actually, the people who own money are still in control, and it's a very hierarchical system, and so it's an appearance. But they've had to nod, they've had to acknowledge the fact that people didn't like this authoritarian, single voice, one received pronunciation. Now, you were talking about America going in a different way, and if I watch CNN on, I put it on my TV and I watch it, my feeling is that there is a very settled, mainstream American way of talking which has authority. It's almost like, and this might be true in other ways, that America is the new imperial power, that it has the absolutely standard way of talking which it can impose on the world, and it's slightly different and it has certain other resonances, but when I watch CNN, I don't feel a multiplicity of different voices.
Right, very interesting point, because this is So McLuhan points out something that seems pretty interesting and real, and then when you start to think about it in terms of class war, and you come back to money, yes, there seems to be something going on now, or something not changing. Now you're watching Americans 50 years after he talked about it. The Americans, the idea that they put on this tribal voice, that is 40 years ago. There's been digital media and all kinds of other effects since then. So it's interesting to get the latest report on what you as an outsider, non-American, see. And I would say, yes, the Americans have become more tribal. It was a transition period in 1670 and a novelty to put on sideburns, McLuhan said. He said that he said Nixon, if he wanted to overcome the pressures of Watergate, all he had to do was put a wig on or put some sideburns on. And it would look like he was being tribal and being like everybody else. He looked too private, McLuhan said. He looked too much like Richard Nixon. He didn't look a lot like other people enough. So that transition of this big deal, people wearing sideburns, has moved so far past that over the last 30 years that America is more British than the British could ever be in the corporate tribal sense. So what you're seeing is, yes, today it's a tribal empire. It's putting on a tribal voice. It's an interesting yuppie consumerist kind of image. I guess upper middle class attempt to be aristocratic with the McMansions. You know what I mean? The McMansions.
Yeah, that's how it sounds. But the other thing about it is it has authority that... And this is why I find Frank Zappa perpetually interesting, because he put life and value in some kind of burp or fart from the underclass. That's what he thought was real and really good, and that was music and that was life. But the rest of media is always telling you that only the sorted out and the cool and the Hillary Clinton suave approach, which is in control of its materials, is the real power, and unless you can master that kind of language, then you're nowhere. And so there's one language, and it's cool, and it's postmodern, and it's fair, and it worries about injustice, but it also justifies the whole system. You know, that's the best thing. That's their argument. That's the thing that they're pushing through. And of course, it's always reaching problems. I mean, it's just reaching, you know, that can't sort out shanty towns. This attitude doesn't, you know, it's a mode of talking, which of course is cool to the people who are talking it, but doesn't work for the world. And yet through media it is available to everybody, and everybody can watch it, and everybody's getting hit by it.
Yeah, that's exactly McLuhan's point, is that this colossal preference, he used to quote Wyndham Lewis, art is a colossal preference. And this colossal preference created by the new art forms, or the new media environments, has millions of people adapting to this authoritative tribal voice that America puts on. But McLuhan said, as in the past in the United States, the normal private corruption that went on behind the scenes revealed by Watergate was normal. Everybody understood that. But when TV came in, the public face of America, the president had to be more pure. Whereas, you know, you go back to Hoover and Coolidge and those people, everybody knew they were crooks, and that was normal because it represented the private level of capitalism in American culture. So the tribalism took over, where people had, the president had to be pure and put on a perfect image, a tribal image, and look like a lot of other people. But he said, paradoxically, people's personal lives became total chaos and messy. And that's, you know, you'd have Nixon would have a kid who was a drug addict, you know what I mean, or something like that. The mess in people's lives privately, caused by television, affected the public institutions to be more pure. And that's when Jimmy Carter came in. He had to be, as Zappa said, it's always interesting what Zappa said. He was a good barometer. He said, the election of Carter was just someone who's holier than thou after the mess of Watergate. You see? And after Carter, then you had Reagan, who acted as an American, the perfect Hollywood archetype. And it's been the same ever since. And so when Clinton, you know, got in trouble in the White House, that was disgusting. He was polluting the the public airways image of the presidency, while in private life, everybody in America was on cocaine or drugs or polluted or a fundamentalist, all kinds of wacky things.
Or even, you know, doing oral sex.
Yeah. And so the reversal of the role of the White House happened with television. But there would be other reversals in other cultures caused by television. Different reversals. I don't know if you... I would say that it became more low class, you're saying, on the BBC. And that was the opposite. They allowed themselves to look more folksy, allowed the local regional accents on, right? They weren't so pure. Now, would Margaret Thatcher, was she a rebellion against that? Was she a representative of a reaction to that, or this change happens after her?
Well, no, I mean, Margaret Thatcher, she's an expression of someone who isn't actually in control of the authoritative, educated voice. You know, she's lower middle class, but she aspires to it. So she produces this kind of simulacrum of authority. I mean, I think if you look at... if you listen to the way Margaret Thatcher expresses herself, if you you know Barbara Stanwyck, have I got the name right? The Hollywood actress.
Yes,
That Margaret Thatcher learned how to speak from her. I think if you put Barbara Stanwyck right next to Margaret Thatcher, you realise who Margaret Thatcher modelled herself on. So, despite claiming to come from this totally English moral centre of conservatism, that Thatcher, in order to communicate, had to use the languages of modern media, so Hollywood, so Barbara Stanwyck, I think, is the real source of her particular, the way she sounds and her particular form of sounding sincere and putting a point across and so on. So what we have is that British conservatism actually doesn't need to act in the modern world, so it's going to use all these things, even though it's pretending it doesn't. And that's what Thatcher, you know, her persona did.
Is that your personal perception about Stanwyck, or that?
Yeah, I've never heard anybody else say this, but as soon as I hear Barbara Stanwyck in a film, I go, "Oh my God, it's Thatcher!" You know, I mean, it's just that's what I think's going on.
Okay, so you have. Do you think that there's a conspiracy, or is that another word for class war, that they put in Thatcher and Reagan? The neocon movement was all, as an ideology, had to be rammed into people's faces, and it had nothing to do with the media preferences that television and the new electronic global culture was bringing in. You think it was purely bureaucratic?
I think in order to act on the world, everybody uses what's around. You know, you do what you can, and you improvise with what's there. And if you're clever and if you're successful, you see what's there to use faster than the opposition. So I don't really see a big distinction between those two things. You know, that I don't think it's either the change from newspapers to television explains everything. I think there are agents, there are people who have their eye on various things, and I'd still, you know, kind of arm wrestle with you, Bob, about what they've really got their eye on. And I think they have their eye on the stocks and shares and money. And I think they want to defend their money, and they'll use anything to make sure that various people who can sit on their asses, not doing any work and making sure their shares are doing all right, if they're okay, everything's okay. So if we can use advertisement hoardings, or we can use television, or there's a bright young person here, he says he can do this, let's use that. But I don't quite accept the McLuhanite, there's an absolute sea change with media. You know, I'm cynical about that, because I think media is, it's a TV, it's in your room. But it doesn't really dominate you, because what really dominates you is getting up in the morning and, how am I going to feed my kids? I think that really dominates you.
Yeah, okay. So McLuhan said that Big Brother went inside once television came in the 50s. So Big Brother was quite obvious in the 30s and 40s as you move into World War II. But after that, Big Brother had to go inside. He didn't say it disappeared, but it had to go inside. Orwell didn't see that. But then again, what's it mean by inside? You could maybe quibble with that. The thing is, the other point is...
No, but I like that. You see, I like what McLuhan is saying there, because he's saying, oh, we've defeated fascism, we smashed it, we restricted communism to Russia, we're all in a free world. And I like the people who come up and say, well, actually, these systems we got in place are producing the same stuff, that it hasn't gone away, that these forms of, you know, that you're not free. And that's why, you know, I adore Zappa, because he burst in the middle of the 60s telling everybody, you're not free. Look at who's, I mean, for me, it's always about look at the TV, who's being paid, why are we getting all this nonsense that doesn't make sense for your life? Why are we being fed all these sappy pop songs which aren't about your life? Why is it unreal? What's going on? And that question mark, and a lot of Zappa's imagery and arguments are about how we talk about, well, we defeated Nazism, we know that that's over there in Germany. Well, actually, there are very similar processes going on just around you. You know, concentration camps that were being prepared for the problem of the Japanese in the Second World War are being readied for hairy people now in the 60s. These kind of warnings, these premonitions of this system is delicate, and when it doesn't work, it's going to be very, very bad. These kind of things, for me, it is a reason why I, in an intuitive way, Zappa found all these things and argued for them. And it's very close for me for a Marxist understanding of capitalism, that fascism is something that's in the wings of capitalism all the time. It's the big boot for when the crisis happens and money needs to be maintained versus people. That's what fascism is. It's always there. And for me, Frank Zappa always had that consciousness. And that's why I find his whole argument and his music so perceptive.
Well, I'm taking, okay, 2 points. First of all, McLuhan used to say that members of the establishment, when they entered public life, meaning modern media life, they always were out of sync with what was really going on, because they had to learn the history of the establishment when they worked their way up through the secret law firms and that to become a member of the establishment. In other words, they had to understand the historical environment of authority behind Big Brother behind the scenes, and they go through that world, spend 20 years making the right connections, and then they represent that and go forward in public and run for office and start to have a public personality. He said they always appear whacked out and nothing to do with today, because they had to spend 20 years learning the ropes behind the scenes. Mm. So I just wanted to say that's an interesting idea. Mm. And then the next thing is, you know, Zappa, for most people, whoever encountered like cab drivers in New York in 60, 67, wouldn't pick Zappa up. He looked like a dirty hippie. And we know that it became a fad to be a dirty hippie in the United States. And by 67, late 67, Zappa saying light shows and all the paraphernalia of the hippie rock culture, he was saying, I wish it would go away. And then I jump ahead to, I don't know, 74, 75. Some journalist comes to him, probably from the LA Times, to interview him, and he's shocked that Zappa goes off and shaves. Make sure he shaved before he lets the picture happen. What is the reason Zappa doesn't want to appear dirty anymore? He was proud to be dirty in 6667, or have that image, and then he's putting it down as it becomes a mass movement, a fad. I mean, the private sensibility of Zappa is continually conflicted with the tribal effect that's happening to youth culture through television. That's something. I think that's some relevance to what you're saying.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. I think philosophically, the root of what we're talking about is a very old philosophical chestnut. It's kind of essence and appearance, and how you deal with appearance and what's essence, and are you true, and how do you seem to other people, and it's an ethical issue. And when you talk about Frank in that particular position, I mean, my feeling would be, well, he wants to be comfortable. I mean, it's about growing up. It's about where you are. That maintaining, being a dirty hippie all the time, wouldn't be how you feel, that you wouldn't be true to, you know, what you want to do and what next. It's kind of like I can just see it. It's not a great political tack he's making. I will go here, I will go there. I find it completely natural in a way that you have a it's to do with families and to do with educating children, that you're telling them all the time, don't be messy. I mean, this is, you know, you're toilet training them, you know, shit in the toilet, you know, or the bathroom or whatever you call it over there. And so you're training your children like that. Now, in adolescence, you have a criticism of all that, and they're like, I want to be in control of my own shit, and, well, maybe I do want to be dirty, and I can't bear all this being told how to do it, and so you have a rebellion that way. And then in your 20s, when you gradually realise that, well, your parents were a bit right about this, and it's not very nice sort of itching and scratching because you sort of haven't had a bath, and, you know, and so there's a sort of banal level of just growing up going on here, which maybe we shouldn't project too much political, although we should project every political idea on, but you have to understand it through the actual facts of growing up and education and hygiene and, you know, what we are.
In some ways, I think of McLuhan's quote. He quoted his friend Harley Parker, who said, good taste is the last refuge of the witless.
Now, yeah, please. I agree with that. I'll drink to that. Yeah.
You'll drink that. Now, it's interesting how some people saw Zappa as a snob. Some of the New York journalists, or, you know, the Robert Christgaus or whatever those guys' names are, the Rolling Stone people, they saw him as a snob. As a matter of fact, I talked to a programmer, interviewed him in Toronto in early 80s, and after he did Frank, he says, well, Frank's a snob. It's interesting the confusing effect for Zappa's image had. First of all, he's seen as a hippie. Then he's immediately, when the hippie culture is starting to get into the media in the summer of 67, he's immediately saying he's a contrarian. He says, we must stop this. I don't know what he was trying to preserve, but he does show something on the freakout list of what he was an educator about. He wanted people to know about good music, but the good music was not what the regular establishment thought was good music. And he also had an aesthetic that included the blues guys. So what level was Zappa snob? I don't know what he was snobbish about, other than he was an individualist who was contrarian to the any tribal fads that came along.
Well, but he probably told Robert Christgau, actually, I think Simon and Garfunkel are just folkish, you know, watery rubbish, you know? I mean, he probably told him straight out that something that this critic really admired and is selling loads of records, and they interviewed them and they're all into them, and he probably made some cutting remark because Frank expressed a direct, rather delinquent there was an interesting quote you sent me about the blues guy. People who like the blues tend to be a bit oppressed. They're the leather jacket guys, the resentful guys, the guys who sit at the back of the class, and Zappa always spoke for those people who are not celebrated and applauded by society, by the people who get hurt by society. And he understood the connection between white teenage hurt and rhythm and blues and black experience, and thought there could be a real fusion of interest there, that it wasn't people who are obsessed with racial divisions come along and say that it's a bad, stupid idea that, you know, that Elvis Presley could have any sympathy with the blues. Whereas if you step back and think, well, where's society and where's power and how do people feel? The blues is an amazing expression of people who don't have any power and yet are going to tell you the truth. And that truth twangs with you. And it's twanged with people all the way up and down the social scale all over the world. And Zappa understood that and he wanted to celebrate that. And it's an articulate, for me, Zappa's like the super articulate statement of what happened in the 60s, which sloughed off a lot of the sentiment and the confusion. And of course the critics who spent their lives like supporting, you know, the little bits on the side, who found this kind of absolute assurance shocking. And when somebody's assured about their aesthetic decisions, they get called snobs.
Okay.
Are you a snob, Bob? Have you been accused of being a snob ever?
Oh, I've been accused of being a snob you know, in different cases, in different contexts. I want to say this, is that McLuhan said the Beatles was the first time that the Cockney, Liverpoolian Cockney accent was in popular culture, was in the mainstream media. And so I was thinking that, well, Zappa was...
Well, I have to correct you there. The Cockney accent is London. Liverpudlian accent is from Liverpool, and they were definitely not Cockney. They were Liverpudlian in the way they their accents, and it did become became mode. I mean, John Peel, the famous disc jockey, who died, didn't he? Anyway, who educated me in a lot of music by his radio programs. He had received pronunciation, proper BBC pronunciation. He went to what we call in England a public school, but which in the States is called a private school, an expensive school. But when he went to the United States, he put on a Liverpudlian accent because it was like the Beatles, and it made him mode. And it got him, when he did DJing in Texas or somewhere, I can't remember, Dallas, I think it was, where he was. And it enabled him to get a foot in the door for becoming a DJ and all the rest of it. So suddenly, people in England were imitating their social inferiors in order to get a foot in the door in the media. And John Peel did that.
Okay, I know who that is.
But that illustrates some of the things you're saying about what McLuhan said about accents and class and new media. You know, John Peel's history really reflects that.
Because you were speaking the global village, you could go to other cultures and use your background differently because it was a different medium or context. That's what causes the confusing of public and private spaces today. But just go back. So the Eskimo, McLuhan used to say, we go up north, we see snow, but the Eskimo sees 50 kinds of snow.
Well, that's an old one. That's a very old one, Bob.
Right. No, but I want to relate it to... Here's McLuhan saying the Beatles was the first time to have the Cockney accent. But to any knowledgeable or normal British person, they don't know. They're not Cockney, they're Liverpudlian. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
So the alibi for McLuhan says, well, I'm not an Eskimo. I can't tell the difference. I'm just saying that the lower class accent or rhythms or music is in the mainstream and popular.
Well, that's absolutely true.
No, let me say that. I'm bringing that up so we don't get distracted by that. Okay. To say that Zappa did the same thing. He brought in the low-class juvenile delinquent culture and put it into pop on albums and that. You see, it's the same absolutely. As the Beatles, from McLuhan's point of view.
Yeah, absolutely. And the interesting thing for me is it's obvious that Liverpool had to produce great pop music and rock music, because actually Gerry and the Pacemakers are better than the Beatles, you know, but they're from the same area. But there were just hundreds of clubs in Liverpool, and it was a port, and it was full of American sailors, and it was thriving. It was like Hamburg. That's why the Beatles went and played in Hamburg. The idea of the Beatles being English is slightly wrong. They're Hanseatic, you know. They're about a society of deviation, produced around ports, sailors, prostitutes, bars, that kind of activity. That's what the Beatles were, and that's why, you know, their first gigs are in Hamburg. And you go, well, why are they in Hamburg? They're English, but they're not. They're part of this what do you call it, transnational proper culture. And you know, they found out about the music by American sailors coming with 45s in their hands of records, which they put in shops, and you know, that's how they found out about the music. So now I've forgotten why I'm saying it.
Good, I'll take advantage of this. I wanted to point out, here's what's interesting. Here's Zappa basically presenting Black and Southern music, especially Beefheart, as an expert on Southern rhythms in the blues and that. McLuhan predicted in 63-64, especially when Goldwater came in, and not Goldwater, Johnson,
Barry Goldwater.
When Johnson beat Goldwater.
Wasn't Barry Goldwater the terrible racist Southern bastard that we have to hate? I seem to remember.
Yes, yeah. And LBJ was the other hated Southern Baptist from Texas.
Yeah. Yeah.
Bastard. But the thing is that McLuhan predicted in 64 that American sensibility will move towards the South, which is very interesting. That if I had a chance, I used to try to bring these things up with Frank, but it was hard to get him to focus on anything that wasn't in front of him on the music console. You know what I mean? But anyways, I said, Frank, you are just a knee-jerk response to the programming caused by television, which moved the sensibility toward the South, which McClellan predicted, and then you propagated Southern culture, did it very well, but you were riding on an effective television, and you'd be shocked that you were a victim of that kind of human engineering.
Well, Bob, but you're falling into the classic McLuhanism that people criticize McLuhanites for, which is that you're finding in media an explanation, whereas I find in actual movement of people the explanation, that Frank Zappa became Southernized or bluesified because of the mass emigration of people from the South into Los Angeles during the Second World War, because they needed labor to build all the airplanes and the amazing technological innovations happening during the war, and people could get jobs, and they moved from Texas and elsewhere into Los Angeles and formed that population, and that created the extraordinary stuff we call R&B and all the rest of it. It was the people at the base, you know, television and newspapers and everything are reflections and wonderful reflections, and you know, do this and do that, and on top of that, art, you know, as a criticism of that, you know, does other things that we should all pay attention to. But really, it's the movement of people needing jobs and trying to propagate their kind, which is the basis of everything we're talking about. That's the real thing, and that's what we need to understand. You know, I'm trying to put my feet on the ground here as a Marxist, and I dissociate myself from this febrile McLuhanism that finds in some kind of media gizmo some kind of ultimate solution. I find it hilarious, silly. You know, I just don't think, you know, you invent the computer and everything changes.
Okay, yes, but why can people move? They got cars, they got televisions, they got telephones. All this media.
Bigger than that, Bob. Bigger than that, Bob. They get ideas. We're really talking about ideas. It's a philosophical issue about people and how they live and how they propagate their kind, and where are ideas in this? All these things you're talking about, they're technological mediations of ideas. Ideas really matter, but where do ideas fit in to how people live? Where do ideas get in? How do they? Do we live on ideas, or how much do ideas matter? Do they not matter at all? Now, this is the real issue. It's ideas and everyday life. That's the opposition, and therefore I find the McLuhanite obsession with different kinds of media a bit of a distraction, because I like to get back to everyday life and ideas.
Well, McLuhan wrote a history of media showing that different ideas have popularity because of the media grounds.
Well, Bob, I love it when you say these things, but at the same time, I feel like you're looking at philosophy through this grid of McLuhanism, and I want to tear it away and say, Bob, look at ideas and everyday life. Actually, you don't need McLuhan. Leave your crutches. Walk. Please walk.
Oh, I have a bigger idea about that than yours. Your ideas are puny. But let me explain that.
My ideas are not puny. They're the basic tradition of philosophy I'm talking here. They're as puny as, you know, Plato and Aristotle. They're puny, yeah.
Yes, and where has your love of ideas and the encouragement of the great population who wants ideas gotten you? It got you fired from Wire. It's got you...
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's the end of the world. It's the end of the world when a music magazine fires you, isn't it?
No, this is a good point. What are ideas?
Yeah.
Okay, what are ideas?
Yeah.
Well, McLuhan didn't think ideas were just based on logocentricity or words.
Of course
ideas
not.
Ideas were based on imagery.
Yeah, they can come from anything at all. I mean, I was telling the story of Derek Bailey, the improvising guitarist who died quite recently, who I wrote a biography of and I admire very much, and I think is the new Bach, the new Johann Sebastian Bach in terms of everything he did. And he told me that growing up in Sheffield, his father had been a miner, he didn't want to go down the mines, that it was seeing a film which gave him the idea, well, oh, he didn't have to go down the mines. He could be an insurance salesman. He could be something different. And seeing an American film completely changed his life idea of what he should be. Now, I'm not so obsessed with media to go, oh, this proves that film is this or film is that. That's an idea. It was mediated via film. Yeah. But, it, you know, I don't... what I dislike about the McLuhanism is this, like, it's almost like the reaction of someone who was too bookish to have him being too bookish, so you swing the other way. I mean, if you're not too bookish, you go, well, here's Derek growing up. What ideas is he going to get? Oh, he got it from a film. It's not such a big deal that it was from a film rather than a book. You know, I don't know what this... It's almost like the reaction of the literary professor to, oh, there's television. But if you're not a literary professor, well, of course there's television. You know, why are you going on about it so much?
Because I would go back to McLuhan saying that poetry was not made from ideas, it was made from words, which is what you celebrate. That's the Ben Watson ideology. You emphasize on your show the wordiness, the linguistic accents, the sounds, the sensuality, not the ideas. You haven't said one clear idea on the shows with Iris the last 3 or 4 weeks. I've just heard burblings and clash of images. The print poetry doesn't even use letters.
Bob, there's nothing but ideas. That's the problem. You haven't got it. It's all ideas.
Okay, give me one idea Prim says. Come on, there's a lot.
What in the recent volume? Well, I got to go and get it. Look, can you talk for a while?
That's not good enough.
No, I need to. You ask me concretely what I can prove it to you. I'll read one line and tell you what the idea is. But I it's only in the next room. Can you please talk to our listeners? We've only got 9 minutes left. Just say to them some information about who we are. You know, do a station ID or whatever you like. But let me just go. It'll only take me 30 seconds.
Yeah, I'm going to take advantage of your absence and get some points across.
Yeah, go on. I'm not listening, but I'm listening.
Yeah, okay. The thing is, if you think what an image is and then what an idea is, most people think ideas are the verbal part of the brain. When they look at imagery, they might get ideas from it, which means the verbal concepts. Now, we're flooded with imagery and flooded with verbal concepts. And if America is the most multimedia society in the world, why are they considered dumbed down? If they're getting ideas from imagery like Bailey got from the film, then they must be super intellects with lots of ideas. But that's not what seems to be communicated. Or is Ben going to say that the authorities, Big Brother, controls the media so no ideas get out? Well, what one idea? What one idea? There's millions of ideas. We have incredible choice of ideas, if you believe ideas are anything.
Ideas are nothing. The only thing is what you could do. The only thing is the potential to change. The if you want to be educated, it's not a matter of like mastering this and absorbing that. It's the moment at which you could change something. You actually understand your relationship to things and how you need them.
Okay, why are people so apathetic up to this point? They might not be apathetic next week. Why are they so apathetic over there in England and here after all their money is evaporated?
Because they haven't heard this show. Now, I'm going to...
I agree.
And
we've got... You want ideas? As McLuhan would say, you want ideas? You don't like those ideas? I got a lot more.
Now, you're very good at glossing poetry, Bob. So I'm going to give you some actual real live poetry just for you to work on. And I have to say, when I read this on my show, which is called Late Lunch Without to Lunch, and you can find it on archive.org by searching on Late Lunch, folks. That's an internet piece of information. And now, Bob, you're going to gloss this. Mild sorrel sworn to balance dish for dish, plenty as a scrap.
Okay, dish and scrap are food related. So it's the old surrealistic and assemblage method of collage of sensory impressions around eating.
Absolutely, yeah. Okay, let's try some more. As black tremor brought into readiness furbish practice, run first outburst space to bruising bitten trail security miss.
Yeah, the dirty underworld of intelligence in MI5 and MI6 related to the Liverpudlian accent.
Yeah. I think that's just hit the nail on the head. You gloss print. Let's do it. Let's have a whole program with glossing print. That's fantastic. we got 30 seconds to go.
Okay, well, back to the ideas. What was the main idea we're putting? Are we putting out main ideas, or we're just trying to find ideas?
We're trying to get the idea, which would be a recognition of your idea, listeners, listening to this, and your reaction to it being more important than us gibbering on.
Yeah, I think about that famous Barry Miles interview with Zappa in International Times, where he said, it's not an idea, it's capitalized, I-D-E-A. And do you remember that part of the interview?
Yeah.
Yeah, see, that's good, Ben. You've read these things closely. You know, as though one other person in the world would remember that sentence in that 40-year-old interview. But yes, Zappa said it was not the idea. I think he thought that Barry Miles was trying to get an idea from it, right?
No.
We're doing the opposite.
There is only the texture and the experience. Good night, folks.